So each time that we meet for Bhagavad Gita study, I begin by sharing readings from what Yogacharya O'Brien prepared and shared as she taught Bhagavad Gita over the past few years. So the first segment, I am principally reading her script with a few side notes here and there. And then after that, I have a few comments that I share from my own reflections, and then time for your comments and questions. So welcome to Gita Study. And let's take a moment to prepare ourselves for examination of this timeless teaching about the nature of reality and how to live in this world skillfully. Please pause for a moment and become centered, awake and aware. Open your heart and your mind to the infinite. We begin by acknowledging that omnipresent reality, the source and substance of all that is, the life of our life, the breath of our breath, the pure light of awareness, the witness to all of our thoughts and deeds, and the source of illuminating knowledge and realization. We offer our gratitude to the saints and sages and to the Kriya Yoga masters who have brought forth their illumined wisdom on the song of God, the Bhagavad Gita. Mahavatar Babaji, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Paramahansa Yogananda, Roy Eugene Davis, Yogacharya O'Brien, and all their disciples, we offer our gratitude. May our study today bring illumination of consciousness. May it support us in being steadfast on our path of awakening. And may it support us in living skillfully in this world. Om, peace, peace, peace. So today we're continuing our study of the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. This is the chapter where Lord Krishna begins to teach the seeking soul Arjuna about the nature of reality and the beginnings of teachings on skillful action or karma yoga. And we left off the last session on verses 14 and 15. So I want to go back there and then we'll go forward from that point. In verse 14, physical sensations, truly Arjuna, causing cold, heat, pleasure, and pain, come and go and are impermanent. So manage to endure them, Arjuna. Indeed, the person whom these sensations do not afflict, O Arjuna, the wise one to whom happiness and unhappiness are the same, is ready for immortality. So in this chapter, we have the description of the immortal self and the teachings of Samkhya Yoga. And here, really, it is Jnana Yoga. The reference to Samkhya is about the ability to discern the unreal from the real, meaning that which is subject to change from that which is changeless. And sometimes this chapter is referred to as Samkhya Yoga, but really it's Jnana Yoga, the path of wisdom, the ability to discern. That distinction is where the beautiful teachings pour forth from the Lord about the nature of reality, which in a sense is the beginning of the spiritual path for us. When we start to suspect that life is not as we thought it was, that we're not going to be able to find happiness or security in the ever-changing conditions in this world. And we begin to wonder where we are going to find true and lasting happiness that doesn't keep escaping us, or a security that is unshakable. This is the foundation for skillful living that we're given here in this second chapter. Anytime you are troubled, return always to this second chapter in the Bhagavad Gita. That's what Gandhiji did. That was the chapter that he chanted every day. I want to read from Swami Prabhavananda's translation of the Gita that he put together with Christopher Isherwood. It's part prose and part poetry. It's really a lovely rendition of these teachings on the nature of reality. There was never a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor any of these kings. These are the words of Lord Krishna. Nor is there any future in which we shall cease to be. Just as the dweller in this body passes through childhood, youth, and old age, so at death, one merely passes into another kind of body. The wise are not deceived by that. These verses are beginning to have us look at what we have experienced in life so far. You were a baby, you were a toddler, you went to school, you were a teenager and a young adult. And depending where you are on that spectrum of the body and mind changing through time, there is that which has remained ever the same. The awareness of that which you are, that is unchanging. The body has continually changed. And so, even so, you at your core have remained the same. Just as the dweller in this body passes through childhood, youth, and old age, so at death he merely passes into another kind of body. The wise are not deceived by that. Feelings of heat and cold, pleasure and pain, are caused by the contact with the senses. With their objects, they come and go, never lasting long. You must accept them. A serene spirit accepts pleasure and pain with an even mind and is unmoved by either. That one alone is worthy of immortality. So this is verse 14 and 15 again. That which is non-existent can never come into being. And that which is can never cease to be. So what is it that you know about yourself? You know that you exist. Nobody has to tell you that. Do you exist? Well, yes, I exist. It's evident to you that you exist. That which is non-existent can never come into being. And that which is can never cease to be. Those who have known this inmost reality know also the nature of this. It is that reality which pervades the universe and is indestructible. No one has the power to change the changeless. Bodies are said to die. But that which possesses the body is eternal. It cannot be limited or destroyed. Therefore, you must fight. I want to read just a few of these verses in poetic form. They're very beautiful to meditate upon. Know this, Atma, the divine self, unborn, undying, never ceasing, never beginning, deathless, birthless, unchanging forever. How can it die, the death of the body? Because it doesn't change the change of the body. So you have to look into your own experience. What you are is pure awareness. Pure consciousness has never changed. The body continues to change. It changes every day. The mind continues to change. It changes moment to moment. But that which you are as the witness, as consciousness itself, is unchanging. Knowing it birthless, knowing it deathless, knowing it endless, forever unchanging, dream not, you do the deed of a killer. Dream not. The power is yours to command it. Worn out garments are shed by the body. Worn out bodies are shed by the dweller within the body. New bodies are donned by the dweller, like garments, not wounded by weapons, not burned by fire, not dried by the wind, not wetted by water. Such is the Atman, not dried, not wetted, not burned, not wounded. The innermost element everywhere, always, being of beings, changeless, eternal. This Atman cannot be manifested to the senses or thought about by the mind. That which you are cannot be known by the senses or thought about by the mind. It can't be known by the mind, even though we can have thoughts about it, but we cannot know it by the mind because it is superior to mind. Just as the senses cannot perceive the mind, the senses are instruments of the mind. So the mind cannot perceive the self because the mind is an instrument of the self. The self is greater than the mind. It is not subject to modification. Since you know this, you should not be grieved or incapacitated by grief. That's a long poetic form. So that is Lord Krishna's instruction to Arjuna on the battlefield of life. He's saying to Arjuna, hey, dude, I added that part. Just checking to see if you're listening. Hey, dude, Uma's notes don't say that, but she would approve. Look at your experience of life in the body, life in this world. Begin to discern what that which changes from that which does not change. So this is the beginning of the path. And part of that beginning of the path is instigated by your sorrow and by your confusion. How can I live? How can I find happiness? How can I find security? How can I succeed in life? little sidebar. I was having a really lovely conversation with, do I call a 16-year-old a young adult? A teenager who thinks they're a young adult.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Earlier this week, beautiful, beautiful human being. And this person was asking me these questions, these almost literally these questions. Well, how can I live in this world in this way? You know, going to high school, being with my friends, yada, yada, figuring out college. How can I find happiness with all this stress and pressure? You know, how can I find security? Everything's changing. What do we know about the future of our world, our planet, our nation? This teenager's literally asking me these questions. How can I succeed in life and be happy? This was the big question. And sadly, I started laughing. And I said, don't worry, we all still have those questions. But I gave him a little hope too. Along the way, I think there was great relief that this was not just some adolescent thing. So we ask ourselves throughout our life, how can I live? How can I find happiness? How can I find security? How can I truly succeed in life? These questions come, and then we finally begin to look at things more deeply. And we begin to become curious about the true nature of things. And that is the first step to being able to discern. It is understanding the nature of reality through intellect, discerning it, having an intuitive grasp of it. Oh, I begin to see how things are now. That's the first step. And this skill is essential for us in order to find the equanimity that is necessary for skillful living. It's necessary for us to realize this truth, and in other words, to experience it directly and regularly. And the purpose of meditation is that we learn how to quiet the mind and experience the changeless nature of the self so that we can live from that truth. Along the way, the Vedic teachings tell us that there are certain skills that we develop on the path. And the first skill is discernment or discrimination. Being able to distinguish that which changes from that which does not change. That's the beginning of the path and the primary skill for a disciple. If you're still looking for everything that changes to bring you lasting happiness or lasting security, you're not yet ready for discipleship. But when you come to see through that and you know, oh, I'm not going to find what I really need there. I don't know where to find it, but I know I'm not going to find it there. When you come to that point, then you begin to have the ability to discern. Then there's a readiness for discipleship, which means you're ready to study, ready to be able to discern, and ready to live a disciplined life. So out of discernment comes the second skill, which is the quality of renunciation. That means that we simply quit chasing after happiness and security in that which won't give it to us. Think about all the time in your life that you spent trying to find happiness and grab hold of it and keep it. And it would just slip through your fingers like sand. I know that never happened to you. Or you can remember one time. when you begin to discern that it is not found there, then there's a natural quieting of that desire to run after the things of the world. It doesn't mean that we don't enjoy the things of the world. We do. And perhaps we even enjoy them more because we are aware of their temporary nature. We don't assign the happiness of the self, which is unconditional, to things that are conditional. We understand that a thing can only give to us of its nature. If something's temporary, which everything in the world is, it is only going to give us temporary happiness. It is only going to bring us temporary security. So we learn to see things for what they are. And there's a quality of renunciation that begins to arise in us. We're no longer enslaved to trying to find unconditional love, unconditional happiness, or unconditional security in the world. We cannot find it in that which is conditional, so we begin to develop the quality of renunciation. In the Gita, we have this metaphor of the chariot. And we saw in the first chapter this battlefield scene, and then comes this request by Arjuna to Lord Krishna, who is the driver of the chariot, to drive it out into the middle of the battlefield so Arjuna can see what he's facing. And there's an underlying metaphor of the chariot and the chariot driver and the horses and the reins that is appropriate for us to be aware of, because it has to do with our discernment and how we begin to develop this inkling of renunciation, how we begin to live skillfully in the world. That's what we find in the second chapter, this metaphor of the chariot. So I have special fun for us. It's okay.
Here goes.
If you aren't using your iPhone, you can probably see. Yeah? Cool. So, in this metaphor of the chariot, and we look at it the way taught in the Vedic teachings, the physical body is represented by the chariot that the self is riding in. Yogacharya writes, I was thinking yesterday about a time, some time ago, when I was offering a presentation at a Vedanta center with a Swami friend, and we were talking on the phone and getting ready to lead the program. And she says, I had a cold at that time and my voice was raspy. And I was just trying to make my way through that. And my dear Swami said, oh, you know, Uma, you must take care of your body. It is your vehicle for enlightenment. And this just felt so precious to me. That level of understanding of the physical body, thinking of the body as your vehicle for enlightenment in this lifetime, you know you must take care of it. Sometimes we think of the body as sacred, as the temple of the Lord, which it is. But there's also this understanding that the body is your vehicle for enlightenment in this lifetime. and care for the body is really paramount. So we have the chariot as the body. And then the horses, which usually there are five, there are four here just as an illustration. The horses represent the senses that are out there in the world. And the road represents the objects of the senses. And the reins represent the mind. The senses are out there in the world, gathering their impressions, but without the connection to the mind, there is no knowledge of what the senses are gathering. It is that connection between the mind and the sensory experience that the sense is perceived, the sense of touch, hearing, sight, taste, and so forth. That it is cognized by the sense mind, by thinking mind. And that is represented by the reins. So you can see where this metaphor is going. To maintain this equanimity that we're called to have on the path, there has to be control of the reins. Otherwise, the horses of the senses are going to run wild in this world. The reins represent the mind. And then in the chariot, this guy, in the chariot, the driver represents awakened intellect, buddhi. And this is the ability to discern where the mind should go to make the right choices. So the way that we see it in the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord, the sattvic buddhi, the light of God is the driver. Lord Krishna is the driver of this chariot. And Arjuna represents the self, the passenger in the chariot. And we know that early on, Arjuna chose Krishna as the driver. So there's a teaching for us right there. Each day, we are to choose the Lord to be the driver of our life. It's not some far-off, distant driver. It is that light of supreme consciousness shining into our faculty of discernment, shining into the mental field. Okay, did you like the show and tell part? Pretty good with this tool. For those listening to the audio, I'm zooming in and out so they can see a picture of the chariot. I want to read you this metaphor written on the Katha Upanishad from Eknath Eswaran's translation. Know the self as Lord of the chariot, capital S. Know the self as Lord of the chariot, the body as the chariot itself, the discriminating intellect as the charioteer, and the mind as the reins. The senses, say the wise, are the horses. Selfish desires are the roads they travel. When the self is confused with the body, mind, and the senses, one seems to enjoy pleasure and suffer sorrow. When a person lacks discrimination and his mind is undisciplined, the senses run hither and thither like wild horses. But they, the senses, obey the reins, the mind, like trained horses when one has discrimination and has made the mind one-pointed. Those who lack discrimination with little control over their thoughts reach not the pure state of immortality, but wander from death to death. But those who have discrimination with a still mind and a pure heart reach the journey's end, never again to fall into the jaws of death. You can also think of this as forgetfulness, right? Never fall into the jaws of forgetfulness. With a discriminating intellect as charioteer and a trained mind as reins, they attain the supreme goal of life, to be united with the Lord of Love. So in this beautiful teaching about awakening, awakening of discernment, discriminatory knowledge, wisdom, there is this kind of natural inclination toward renunciation that comes. And then there's a progression of the transformation of the mind and the way that we live that comes from our sadhana, from our spiritual practice, from our dedication, and specifically from our meditation, but also from the way we are living in the world with this new awareness. There are six attributes or skills that I want to mention before I conclude. Out of the ability to restrain the mind, there comes calmness that ensues. We have to develop the skill of being able to restrain the mind. And once you start to meditate, you can observe how the mind will start to spin out. And as a disciple on this path, you develop the skill for being able to restrain the mind. Don't go there. Don't go there. We have practices recommended in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, such as cultivating the opposite. And Yoganandaji taught about this often. If your mind is spinning out on anger or fear, you turn the mind towards love or towards fearlessness or courage. You learn how to cultivate the opposite, how to change your mind. From being able to have mental restraint, being able to manage the mind and change the direction of thoughts, comes discrimination. Discrimination comes from being able to observe our thoughts. Prior to spiritual awakening, most people do not ever observe their thoughts. They're being driven by their thoughts. They're being driven by these wild horses, and the reins are just flapping in the wind. But when we have begun this to have this discrimination and renunciation, then we're cultivating the ability to manage the mind. We're becoming mind managers. We're beginning to become able to change the direction of our thoughts. But willpower will only go so far. You get tired, and then you think, oh, you know what? I'm just going to do it. What harm is it going to do? I need a little treat. I need a little break from all of this discipline. That happens when we're relying on willpower alone. And therefore, willpower alone won't do it. We have to have the quality of surrendered willingness. This surrender to the divine charioteer, the Lord of Love, that can shine the light of grace into our life and help us make the right choice at the right time. This is surrendered devotion. Surrendered willingness also helps us with control of the sense organs. It can come through willpower, but in a higher way, through surrendered devotion. And then beyond that, there's the cessation of desire in the mind itself. Those of you who've been on a path of recovery, if you're far enough in recovery, you can relate to this. First, there is this driving sense desire, and you're off and running. You're off to the bar, you're off to the bakery, you're off to gambling, online, whatever it is. You're off to working extra hours, whatever it is. And then there's a time of awakening, of discernment and renunciation, and a path that you go on that you begin to change your behavior. You have to use a certain amount of willpower to not take yourself into those situations. You get the reins and you don't take yourself into those situations where you know you're going to be tempted by those desires. You begin to lessen that desire. You begin to have some willpower and you begin to open yourself to the willingness of divine grace. After this power of restraint, there comes a cessation of desire in the mind itself. There comes this cessation of desire in the mental field. There's a freedom that ensues, and that is a grace of God on the path. You can see how this moves us toward freedom. And then with this comes freedom from the desire in the mind that drives the senses, that really only comes through realization, through meditation, through the transformation of the mind itself. Paramahansa Yogananda talked about this change. The arise of desire in the mind is not so much just about our ability to manage life. Like saying, I just accept life as it is. There's ups and there's downs. I just accept it. It's not that. It's finding that there's a higher way to be. You're not going up and down, but you're finding that higher happiness in the self that is unchangeable, and you're rooted in that. And that begins to purify the mental field. One finds an absence of desire arising from the mind, and from that comes forbearance, titiksha, an imperturbability, which is the goal of the path, so that you can remain anchored in the self. The mind is not moving all the time. It's an equanimity that is different from just saying, okay, I see into the nature of life. It's going up and down. I can endure that because I know it's going to change, right? That's called white knuckling it. That's one level. But the deeper level is I endure that because I am anchored in that which is unchangeable. That's the deeper way of forbearance. That is imperturbability. Beyond this imperturbability is the awakening of faith. We begin to have the experience of that divine reality, and then we're able to just live and move and have our being in that. Faith in the self, faith in the teachings, faith in the teacher, faith in our own abilities to experience the truth of our being and then beyond that. So the last on the list, the sixth, is the ability to focus the mind, the ability to concentrate, the ability to be steadfast on the path and not get distracted. with all of these attributes of awakening, one unfolds into the next as skills for living. And that will be our topic next time, karma yoga, which is when the Lord begins to shift from jnana yoga to the teachings and the teachings of the nature of reality. Now, knowing this nature of reality, you are here to fulfill your dharma, to do what is yours to do in this lifetime, because fulfilling your dharma will be your path to purification. It will be the way in which the six attributes are experienced, the way that you grow in wisdom. I want to conclude with this quote from Swami Sri Yukteswar, and here's just a little teaser of karma yoga that we'll come back to next time. Sri Yukteswar, the guru of Paramahansa Yogananda, said, "Do all work without deviating from the center of self-knowledge." Or you could say it this way, do all work centered in self-knowledge, capital S. Do service only for the purification of oneself. That is such a powerful teaching. Do service only for the purification of oneself. If you know that, you will free yourself from resentment, from asking, why am I doing this? You're doing your dharma for the purification of your own self, for your own awakening. When I came across that quote by Swami Sri Yukteswar, Yogacharya writes, I could just bow to my Guruji and remember him saying so many times, the work that we do in the world is offered with gratitude for those we are privileged to serve. The work that we do in the world is offered with gratitude for those we are privileged to serve. Because any way in which we are privileged to serve is the vehicle for our enlightenment. It is our path of awakening. We can find freedom in action in all that we do. If it is known, if it is recognized, if it is seen in this way. May these teachings be a balm of healing for you. May they be the sweetness of your soul that permeates your life. Om, peace, peace, peace. That was long.
It was good.
Right?
That's good.
I know you're wondering, what are the six things? Maybe I'll tell you later. I just have a few comments to make. So the six things that I drew out of this are this. One, discernment. Two, renunciation. Three, surrender. Four, my new favorite word, imperturbability. Five, faith. And six, concentration. It would have been nice if her notes just said 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Discernment, renunciation, surrender, imperturbability, faith, and concentration. It's a good map. Now we know that the Bhagavad Gita is not merely a sacred scripture. It is a call to action. It's a revelation of truth that meets us exactly where we are on the path. And in these verses, Krishna addresses again Arjuna's hesitation, his fear, his confusion in the face of duty. Arjuna does not want to fight. He's overcome with sorrow, and he's caught in the illusions of the mind, and he's burdened by his attachments. But Krishna reminds him he is not his body, nor is he the fleeting emotions that cloud his vision. He is the eternal self, and from this knowing, he must rise and act. These verses remind us of a fundamental teaching of Kriya Yoga, the importance of the distinction between the transient and the eternal. We live in this world of duality that has its ups and downs, yet at the core of our being, there is something unchanging, something beyond birth and beyond death. This is our true nature. For Kriya Yogis, it's not just some abstract philosophy, but a direct experience. And through our meditation and through our practices of pranayama, or breathing and pranic control and other practices, we shift our identification from the temporal to the eternal. We see that the fluctuations in life, success and failure, joy and sorrow, are like waves upon the ocean, but we know we are not the waves. In truth, we are the vast, unchanging depth beneath the waves. So if we know that we're eternal, why must we act? There's more of the questions that matched up with the teenager. Why do anything? Why must we engage in the world? Well, knowing about the nature of reality is not enough. We must live in harmony with it. And this means fulfilling our dharma, our rightful duty. For Arjuna, this means fighting on the battlefield. For us, it means stepping fully into this life that we have been given. And each of us has a unique path, a sacred responsibility in this lifetime. Fulfilling it is not about personal ambition or worldly success. It's a means of purification and awakening. The practice of Kriya Yoga teaches us that action, when performed in the spirit of self-offering, becomes a vehicle for liberation. So instead of acting from ego, we act from awareness. Instead of seeking results, we act with devotion. And in doing so, our actions purify the mind, and they draw us closer to experiencing God directly. Krishna reminds Arjuna in chapter 2, verse 22, just as a person casts off worn out garments and puts on new ones, the soul casts off a worn out body and enters a new one. This is a profound teaching on non-attachment. The yogi learns to let go, not just of material things, but of false identifications. Identifying with the limiting beliefs that keep us small. So in Kriya Yoga, every breath, every moment of stillness in meditation, every intentional action is a letting go. It's a practice of surrender, of recognizing that we indeed do not control the outcomes of our actions. We are instruments of the divine. So Krishna's words are not just for Arjuna. They're for each of us. Now is the time to act. Now is the time to embrace our dharma, not from fear, not from hesitation, but from the clear knowing of who and what we are. So your dharma, whatever it may be, is your unique path to self-realization. Embrace it fully. Give your whole self to it. Live as a yogi without attachment, without fear, and with surrendered devotion. And through it, you will come to know your true self, the eternal, the changeless, the divine self within. Oh. I loved that I had already been working on this for some time, and then I got to have that time with the teenager. Mm-hmm. And he was basically going through this whole lesson. It just made me chuckle. You know, but the deep despair. The good news is I suggested that he read the Bhagavad Gita, and he agreed mm-hmm. to do it. And I said, here are some good commentaries. And he said, well, I think first what I'll do is I'll read it and I'll just decide what I think. I said, that's perfect. That is the advanced level of doing this. But then you need to read some commentaries to check yourself and, you know, get some extra guidance. So we all have these questions, don't we? Pretty much every day and often every moment. You know, how do I live? How do I find happiness? How do I let go of attachment to this or to that? You know, how do I show up and be firm and, you know, fight, or let's say hold a boundary or give clear direction where needed? You know, I don't mean fight, but making a boundary or self-correcting some situation in our life, that's a fight in a way. How do I do this and maintain my equanimity? Chapter 2 is a good start on that. And our next section about karma yoga will go further. So we have a few minutes. This was another long teaching from Umaji, which we're grateful for. I don't know. I feel like I'm talking so fast, but I must be going much slower than she does. I'm happy to hear from you all, your reflections, ahas, oh-ohs, oh-nos, yahoos. I did get a few comments about the yugas from people from our last time together. About how hopeful that made people feel to step back and think about, you know, the 24,000 years cycle of the yugas instead of the 4 years that we're facing right now. Mm-hmm. You know, 4 years, 24,000 years, and you know, we're moving right now. Yuga is the most enlightened state, and then we move all the way down to Kali Yuga, which is the most unenlightened state, and then it turning back up toward Dwapara, and we have just moved, according to Swami Sri Yukteswar, from Kali Yuga into Dwapara Yuga, moving back toward Satya. So as I mentioned, there's that point of friction and chaos that is necessary to break through and have change. So in many ways we can go, yes, we are right on track. We might not like how it looks or feels, but you know, we are in the midst of those, or in the company of those, I should say, who are on a path of awakening. And so, when you have an awareness that the larger part of the world's population doesn't have, not that we're special, there are many people in many religions and faiths who are enlightened and on paths of enlightenment, but when you're in that midst, to also be in the midst of the darkness and the sense of tragedy of it can be painful. So here we are. All right, I see Carrie's hand and then Cynthia after that. Hi, Carrie, nice to see you.
I love your thoughts, it's wonderful. And I just wanted to say that I loved your "I need a break from discipline." I get that a lot. So just the endurance needed to stay on this path and keep the chariot moving. I'm like, okay, here's all my homework. I turn it in. Now where's my self-realization? I just feel like it's just still needs to be that way. So I definitely need a break from discipline. It's something I thought, well, what do I get to stop meditating to go on vacation? But I don't want to go on vacation.
Carrie, we can't hear you very well. I don't know if it's just on our end. So we're seeing, we can. Saraswati, I see your head. Is it just on our end? Can you hear her okay?
They can.
Okay, so just lean into your mic if you can.
Oh, she meant.
Oh, now we can't hear you at all.
Never mind.
There, that's good.
Okay, how's that? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, I'm on, you're on a speaker, everybody. It must not be meant to be. Thank you so much. I'm good. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you, Carrie. It's so nice to see you. All right.
Lilia and Cynthia.
Cynthia, then Lilia.
It's very, very interesting to witness all this because I started in 73 reading the Bhagavad Gita alone. I had, and learning to meditate from Paramahansa Yogananda's fellowship. And I'm seeing a pattern here because I have been in and out of the darkness and episodes of light and dreamy things with Krishna. And I've had wonderful either heightened states or episodes of enlightenment, but I always come back in a cycle down to the dark again. And I just figured out after 72 years of being here that the times that I went into the darkness, I had stopped meditating because of being busy, raising the kids, going to work. All those activities drew me away from the path. And then I couldn't figure it out. Why was I losing it? Now I know. And so this is so precious to me. And I have no time to lose. I am just going to hang on to those reins. Because, honey, I keep falling off the chariot. Thank you so, so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia. Yeah, right? I think most of us are at this place where we're like going, okay, I've got no more time to be messing around. Let's get on with it. So thank you for saying that for so many of us. Is it Lilia? Can you unmute yourself?
Yes. Thank you for beautiful lectures and discernment. I would like some clarification between renunciation and surrender.
Differentiation between renunciation and surrender.
Between renunciation and surrender.
Well, often renunciation is thought of as being more like letting go of attachments to things. Two things. Like letting go of my attachment to relationships being a certain way or to things in the world. Surrender is thought to be more a letting go into something. So one is like letting go of external, temporal things in the world. The other is letting go into God or Divine Mother, wisdom, however you think of that higher truth, love, however you think of that. So one is letting go of, one is letting go into.
Thank you.
That was a brilliant question. Thank you. Wasn't that a great question?
Mm.
Okay, others? Rose, it's so nice to see you. Thank you for being here with us. Of course, we're all thinking of you always. I see Mukti Devi has her hand up.
Thank you. I love this in many ways. It seems to me very interesting that we find we have the direct experience when we come to know ourselves as we are, to let go of the temporal, to lean into and understand ourselves as the unchanging reality. And then from that place, come back into the physical world and live from there. So it's like where our forgetfulness comes from, our identification, or our, you know, identification with the world. We come to realize that which we are. And then we carry that back into the world so that then we can become enlightened. And it's this, the subtle interplay of ourselves and understanding and coming from an understanding of ourselves as a subtle spiritual being and then embracing our dharma within the spiritual world. I'm understanding better and letting go a little bit more of the self-recrimination that I have for forgetting. That's a really hard and subtle line. And each of us has a different, when you say we must find our dharma, the answer is not going to be the same for any of us.
No. Isn't that great?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Therefore, we have a beautiful rainbow.
It is beautiful. It's just, I guess I'm wanting to hear confirmation that I'm understanding.
Yes. And you know, Umaji, Yogacharya O'Brien, I've often heard her say, in the beginning, we come to the path and we take ourselves out of the world and begin to dive deep into our practice and our spiritual journey, only so we can bring ourselves back into the world where we can make a true difference.
Yes, thank you. I've heard you comment that once you talked about wanting to stay in the Himalayas, and Umaji said, no, you were born here.
And well, no, I said I wanted to stay in silence.
Okay, that's right. Excuse me.
Yeah, Himalayas is a good idea too, as long as it's a, you know, 5-star hotel.
No, I
told her after a silent retreat, I wrote a note that said, you know, I would like to remain in silence. And she started laughing. And she said, what you're remembering, she said, you were not born in the Himalayas.
That's it. Yeah.
Born here, and you have work to do in this world. Now, what do you have to say?
This path is truly not an escape from a world that isn't going the way we would like it to.
That's correct.
It's preparation to re-enter.
That's correct.
Okay.
And as Cynthia said, and as Lilia said, really, we first need to remove ourselves regularly. We need to have an experience deeply and regularly of our true self through surrender, through renunciation and surrender. So when we step into our daily activities, we're doing so with the light of consciousness. First, we remove ourselves from this world where we're changed, and then we bring ourselves back into this world to make a difference. I love that when Uma would say that. Are there any comments in the room? We have a few people here. It's so nice to be with you all. And I look forward to being together next week. It's a full week, Tuesday night, and during the day for a few. Tuesday night, we have Shivaratri, and I'll sleep fast, and then Wednesday work on Gita study, and then we'll be together Thursday morning. So in a way, it'll be like a retreat week. And then
chanting retreat 28.
And then the next day, Friday, evening. Not this week, next week, Friday evening and all day Saturday, we have chanting and Hatha Yoga and meditation retreat with Mukti Devi and Janardhan. That's in person only. And then Sunday we have our next attunement satsang. So, and then to lead into all of it, this Sunday we have Reverend Saraswati, is this right?
Yes.
Offering our message on Sunday. So we are infinitely blessed by many people fulfilling their dharmas. I look forward to continuing this journey with you. And thank you for your presence and for your kind attention. Om.